Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, EQMM's editor. This month we feature the work of Seamus Derringer and International Thriller Award-nominated author Andrew Welsh Huggins, whose latest novel, The End of the Road, was named by Library Journal one of the best thrillers of the first half of 2023. The Cleveland author is also the creator of a 7-book Private Eye series starring Andy Hayes, a former Cleveland Browns quarterback turned investigator. Hayes is the star of the holiday story Andrew Welsh Huggins wrote for EQMM a few years ago. Here is the author reading his story Home for the Holidays from the January-February 2020 issue of EQMM.
Give me Halloween. Give me Easter. Give me July 4th. Hell, I'll even take St. Swithin's Day. But please, please spare me Christmas. Put me to sleep the morning of December 21st, longest day of the year anyway. Wake me right before New Year's Eve, and I'll be happy as Donner and Blitzen. Because otherwise, the holiday makes me feel like a charter member of the Donner Party. I mean, can you blame me? For starters, I'm usually alone the day of, which is what happens when you're twice divorced with a son from each marriage, neither of whom considers opening presents around a bonsai-sized tree and then watching Die Hard for the 100th time the highlight of the holiday season. And while I shouldn't complain, it's my busiest time of year by far. Thanks to all the misery Christmas makes possible, the need for my private investigating services rises as predictably as the annual airing of Rudolph. To wit, the affairs launched at office parties, the shoplifting to ensure happy faces on December 25th, the charity scams that cost widows half their savings. There's only so much pain a guy in Columbus, Ohio can endure when the world's supposed to be all peace on earth, goodwill to men, and stuff. And I'm not even going to mention the happy couples I see strolling down brick sidewalks in German Village, arm in arm as they admire the lights, while I look forward to another evening at home by myself. Unless you count a gassy Labrador who hogs the covers. No, Christmas was never my cup of tea or mulled wine, and this year was proving no exception. "I'll make it simple for you, Mr. Hayes," the woman said. "First I want you to find my husband, then I want you to kill him." December 15th. Only 10 shopping days to go. I was sitting in the living room of Walter and Donna Hamrick in a tidy split level off Sandalwood on the north side of town. Outside, the temperature was dropping as flurries whirled weakly in the air, unable to decide whether to stay or to go. Inside, the temperature was even colder as Mrs. Hamrick stared dully at her husband's empty chair beside a fully decorated tree. I shifted in my seat and said, "I don't think that's advisable." "Don't be ridiculous. I'm only kidding. I'm just so angry at him when I'm not worried to death." She was mid-50s, heavy set, wearing jeans and a white cardigan over a pullover red turtleneck. Hastily applied makeup was doing a poor job hiding circles under her eyes. "Let's take it from the start. When you called this morning, you said he was missing." She nodded. "It's been 2 days. He got up Tuesday, went to work, never came home." "And the note was all you found?" "On my pillow." I picked up the piece of paper and read it again. "There's something I have to do. I won't be gone long." A neat, almost old-fashioned cursive. "You're sure that's his handwriting?" "Yes. It hasn't changed in years." "And no idea what he's talking about?" "Absolutely not. Walter's a creature of habit. A homebody, if you want the truth. He never goes anywhere." "Where does he work?" "He's down at Spurf." "Spurf?" I conjured an image of a Bond villain holding Walter hostage. "The State Public Educators Retirement Fund," she said. "The agency that manages the money that teachers retire on in Ohio. It's across the street from the original Wendy's, the one that closed. It has a fountain with a giant ABC in the middle." I nodded, picturing it now. Several retirement funds, for police and firefighters and others, had offices along the same stretch of East Broad, along with a couple big insurance companies. All those hard-working accountants, you'd think they could support one lousy hamburger joint, especially the very first in a chain. But they couldn't, and one more city landmark was gone forever. There really is no going home again, even when you're still at home. I said, what's he do? He's an auditor of sorts. Meaning? He works in their appraisals department, but he doesn't appraise anything. What's there to appraise? She looked surprised. Real estate, of course. Spurf has properties all over the country, part of their financial holdings. Walter audits the appraiser's quarterly reports. She sighed. They're always jetting off to fancy places like New York and Chicago and Los Angeles, and he's the one cleaning up their math when they get back. But then guess who gets the Christmas bonuses? Is he unhappy there? Walter? I don't think so. That was my commentary on the situation. He's a brilliant accountant. I just sometimes wish he had, you know, a bit more get up and go. What does Spurf say? I mean, about where he is. Not much, she replied. They say he didn't show up Tuesday or yesterday. Right now they consider him absent without excuse. The police? I filled out a missing persons report. The detective said unless there are signs of foul play, there's not a lot they can do. And of course he left a note. Where do you think your husband is, Mrs. Hamrick? I have no idea, she said, her eyes brightening for the first time since I sat down. Was he feeling depressed? Acting unusual in any way? Not exactly. Oh? He'd seemed a bit distracted lately, and there was... Yes? Someone came to the house Monday night, a man, after Walter got home. He wouldn't let him inside, and he wouldn't tell me who it was afterward. Just a work thing, no big deal, he said. It struck me as odd, but I do know they're busy this time of year, the end of the quarter and all that. Did you get a look at him? Just a glimpse. No one I knew. I sat back in my chair. It was an odd coincidence coming the night before Walter disappeared. It might be related, but how? In my experience, it could have been almost anyone. A bookie come to collect, a lover's aggrieved husband, a pain pill dealer making a house call. I'd seen all those and more in some of Columbus's best neighborhoods. I said, do you have a picture of your husband? She leaned forward, picked a print off the coffee table, and handed it to me. I studied the photo. Sandy hair receding. Weak chin on a fleshy face. Wispy mustache that barely stretched to the corners of his mouth. Slump posture with a paunch soon to graduate to authentic belly. But not an unhappy-looking man. A man central casting might produce if you summon someone who audits the appraisals of people just in from New York and Chicago and Los Angeles. People who get the bonuses while he dots the I's. Mrs. Hamrick said, can you help me, Mr. Hayes? I just want him home for the holidays. That's all. Whatever's happened, whatever's wrong, I know we can fix things. But I can't bear not knowing. I'll do my best, I said, even as I struggled to put the worst out of my mind. As the days lengthened and the temperatures dropped, Columbus had more and more dark corners, where an out-of-sorts man with something he needed to do could find peace permanently. An hour later, I parked in front of Capital University's law school, zipped my jacket against the cold. Jay walked across East Broad and looked up. And up. The State Public Educators Retirement Fund building was bigger than I remembered, a gleaming seven-story multi-level edifice of glass and steel soaring above its neighbors, including the old Wendy's, now a Catholic diocese office building. Inside, the lobby's profusion of artfully landscaped plants and bushes and actual trees left the impression of a giant terrarium, a comparison aided by the tinkling of water cascading over boulders into a reflecting pool whose surface was occasionally broken by multicolored koi the size of bread loaves. I thought briefly of my mother, a high school math teacher, scraping pennies together to buy batteries for students' calculators in the rural Ohio district where she taught. At the security desk, I was handed a visitor's badge and told to report to the fifth floor. As I stepped off the elevator, I was greeted by a woman who introduced herself as Nancy, the executive administrative assistant. Pleasant looking, with black hair touched by gray, wearing a Christmas sweater involving golf-playing elves and with a figure that brought to mind a younger Mrs. Claus if she hit the elliptical a couple times a week. Andy Hayes, she said, looking me up and down. You know, my ex-husband thought you were the biggest bum to ever walk the earth. He'd need to take a ticket. I could care less, that's for sure. I don't know the first thing about football. Some people said the same about me. Despite the passage of more than a few years, my reputation as the Ohio State quarterback who blew the national championship once upon a time still manages to precede me, even inside state pension fund headquarters, apparently. "I'll give you this," she said, an appreciative gleam in her eye. "You didn't get the memo about letting yourself go in retirement, or do you just have a good plastic surgeon? Would you believe vitamins and Tai Chi?" Her snort was interrupted by two men in blue overalls exiting the elevator and pushing a trolley past us that was heavy laden with cardboard boxes. "Moving day?" "I wish," Nancy said. "Christmas office party tonight. You'd think it was the second coming of Jesus, pardon the pun." "Not a fan?" "Just a giant headache ahead of time. The board wants the real deal now that the fun's back on track, so it's a lot of preparation. Carving station, strolling carolers, open bar, even a guy in an actual Santa suit." She rolled her eyes. "At least things are going well. Not every company can say that." "I guess it depends on who you talk to around here."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning nothing, and if you'll excuse me, the tinsel just arrived." She gestured as the opening of the elevator doors signaled another load of boxes. "I'll let them know you're here."
"Thanks.
Just curious. Will you be wearing that sweater to the party?" She looked down. "This old thing? Not a chance. I've got much worse at home, believe me." A couple of minutes later, I was seated in a back conference room, staring at large framed photos of Spurf properties in Miami mounted on the wall, when the door opened and two people entered. A woman introduced herself as April Glover, head of human resources. She, in turn, introduced Stuart Benning, head of security. But it was okay if I called him Stu. Neither of them seemed happy to see me, and both accepted my business cards as if they were something I'd used to scrape gum from the underside of city park benches.
"You had some questions about Walter," April said, glancing at Stu.
"Only one. Do you know where he is?"
"What's the nature of your request, if I may ask?"
I summarized my meeting with Donna Hamrick. "His wife is worried. I know from her he hasn't been to work for 2 days, at least according to what somebody here told her. 3, if you count today. She said that's not like him."
"She's right that he's now missed 3 days of work," April said. "My age, 40-ish, short hair highlighted, wearing pearls and a power powder blue suit. Professional, but not authoritarian."
"To repeat, any idea where he is?"
"I'm afraid not."
"Is he in trouble?"
"What makes you ask that?"
"Years of investigative experience, plus the fact your director of security is sitting in on a meeting about an employment matter." Stu narrowed his eyes at me, a cat ready to pounce, but didn't respond. He was clean-shaven with a flat top that recalled Apollo-era flight engineers, with a type of drooping jowls that somehow give an older man a boyish look. Wearing a dark, tailored suit, he had the air of an ex-cop who traded up 20 years on the job for a corner office and a company car.
"I'm not at liberty to discuss the status of individual employees," April said, "and Stu is here merely as a formality, given your inquiries."
"A professional courtesy," Stu said.
"I appreciate that. And perhaps as a professional courtesy, you could stretch the rules a little and just tell me if Walter's got a work-related problem his wife should know about, which might help explain where he's gone. If not, this makes it a personal matter, which I'll sort out with her."
April and Stu traded glances again.
"I really..." April began.
"Walter had some disciplinary issues recently," Stu interrupted. "We assume his absence is related to that."
"Disciplinary issues but not fired?"
"That's correct," Stu said. "And to be honest, we wouldn't mind knowing where he is ourselves. Out of concern for his safety," he added quickly.
"Stuart," April said, steel in her voice, "I really don't think..."
I said, "His wife said someone came by their house Monday night after hours to talk to him. Any idea who that was? Maybe someone from Spurf?"
I eyed Benning carefully, picturing him at the Hamrick's door.
"Doesn't ring any bells," he said after a moment.
"What kind of issues are we talking about?" I said. "What did he do?"
Stu looked at April and nodded. Reluctantly, she said, "I can't go into the details. Let's just say it involves misappropriated funds."
"How many?"
"A lot."
"Are the police involved?" Stu started to reply, but this time April cut him off. "That's really all we can say, Mr. Hayes. I'm sure you can understand our need for privacy, given the allegations." "I'm sure I can," I said, not sure at all. On my way out, I stopped by Nancy's desk. "I hear Walter Hamrick might be on Santa's naughty list. Is that what you meant before about it depending on who you talk to?" "I shouldn't have said that," she said, face coloring to the approximate shade of her sweater. "What should you have said?" She looked away. "Maybe more about what my ex thought of you." My exertions inside Spurf left me with both a bad feeling and an appetite. I walked down the street to Super Chef's and ordered an omelet, home fries, and toast. While I waited for my food, I called Mrs. Hamrick. The shock in her voice, when I explained what I'd learned, reverberated over the line. "Walter? Embezzling? That couldn't be. He what?" "He has his faults, but he's not a thief." I wasn't looking forward to my next question. "I'm sorry to ask you this, Mrs. Hamrick, but does your husband own a gun by any chance?" "A gun? Why? It's just routine, covering all the bases. In case of what?" she said, alarmed. "If you could just answer the question." The phone went silent. After a moment, she said, "He inherited his father's service revolver from the Korean War. But it's locked away someplace. I haven't seen it in years. You don't think..." "I don't think anything. It's just a standard question in these cases." "Oh, God. You think he might hurt himself. Is that it?" I weighed my response. "That Christmas season misery I mentioned?" I'd concluded more than one missing person assignment in December by finding a body and a note. "It's something we have to consider." "That's impossible," she said through tears. "None of this is the Walter I know. I asked you to find him, not ruin his reputation." She hung up before I could answer. I couldn't blame her. But the reality was, Walter Hamrick wouldn't be the first person to kill himself after being caught stealing company funds, and he wouldn't be the last. I thought back to Nancy, and not just because of how she looked in her Christmas sweater. "I guess it depends on who you talk to around here." What had she meant by that? That people were on edge because of a snake in the grass, that being the esteemed Walter Hamrick, or something else? Finished with my meal, I walked back to my Honda Odyssey, climbed inside, found Kevin Harding's number, and called. The dispatch reporter answered on the second ring. "Why do chills run down my spine whenever I hear your voice?" he said. "It's my magnetic personality. It affects people's natural metallic alloys." "In your dreams. What do you want?" "Ohio State's top running back just got arrested for DUI, which means the world as we know it has ended. Unless you're offering some color commentary?" "My commentary is he should get a good lawyer, and people in this town should get a life. But that's not why I was calling." I gave him the bare bones of what I'd learned at Spurf, leaving out Hamrick's name. "Spurf, huh? You're playing with the big boys now. What's that supposed to mean?" "If your guy disappeared, it could be because he's suddenly stinking rich. Those employment funds aren't quaint little retirement accounts. They deal in capital B billions of dollars. We're talking massive portfolios, major real estate holdings, blue chip investments out the wazoo. He may have a million or more reasons to stay missing, and they may have just as many reasons to find him." "Okay, I can see how that would look bad." "Look bad again, you mean?" "I don't follow." "Maybe you were on a stakeout when this happened. A few years back, half the board resigned and a bunch of top execs got fired when we reported they'd all been jetting off to conferences in Hawaii and Vegas on the fund's dime. You can imagine how rank-and-file teachers felt about that. They also took a big hit financially because it turned out those same execs had bollocksed a bunch of investments. No Christmas bonuses that year, I can tell you." "Bollocksed?" "Sorry, my wife and I have been watching a lot of Masterpiece Mystery lately. You get the idea. Another scandal, especially involving finances, would be a disaster." "That may explain my reception at Spurf this morning, but it still feels like I'm missing something." "I can poke around a little, as long as you promise me first crack at any story that comes out." "Have I ever denied you that pleasure?" "I'm not going to dignify that with a response," he said, ending the call. Instead of driving off, I stayed in my van, staring at the Spurf Tower of Power. Put together what I knew so far. Walter Hamrick, a quiet homebody, disappears the day after someone pays him a visit at home. Someone from Spurf? He says in a note he has something to do. His employers suggest he had good reason to vanish, his fingers having been caught in the till. A matronly secretary, the type that usually knows everything, in my experience, hints at something rotten inside Elsinore. Kevin Harding at the Dispatch lays out the fund's reasons for wanting to avoid bad publicity about its money management at all costs. I put things together so long that when I finally came up with a plan, the van was freezing and falling snow was accumulating on sidewalks and curbs and tree branches all around me. I started the engine, pulled into traffic, and went over what to do next. A few hours later, I sat on the edge of a bed in a room at the Rest Easy Motel on Route 161 between Carl Road and Cleveland Ave, my wallet $39.99 lighter, not including the disinfectant spray I'd brought along. I was a mile, maybe two, from the Hamrick's house off Sandalwood, but several tax returns lower demographically. Struggling strip plazas along the four-lane thoroughfare sat beside shuttered big-box retail stores. Many of the Rest Easy guests appeared to be serving their own customers at regular intervals as afternoon turned into evening. I patted the Louisville Slugger I held in my lap, an implement I keep around in case league softball or other forms of organized mayhem break out. I reviewed the call I'd placed to Spurf's head of security an hour earlier. One security guy to another, I tracked down Walter Hamrick, I whispered in my voicemail to Stuart Benning. Gave the Rest Easy address and room number. Disconnected and went back to watching the Cavs play the Lakers on a TV screen whose fuzzy reception matched the snow falling outside. The knock came just before halftime. I stood up, bat in hand, and approached the door. Yeah? Manager, I heard Benning say. Need you to move your car. One sec. I waited a strategic 10 seconds before unlatching the door chain and turning the deadbolt. As soon as the bolt clicked home, the handle turned and the door opened. Benning pushed his way forward, a gun in his right hand. He started to speak before stopping, boyish face frozen, as his brain registered my identity. Say Roquefort, I said, snapping a picture with my phone. What are you doing here, he said with a scowl. And where the hell is Hamrick? I'm just a guy waiting for you to lower that piece before I answer any questions. Listen. No, you listen. One of us could get hurt, and I don't want it to be me. He scanned the room and its stained bed comforter and watermarked walls with the expression of an interior designer about to be ill. He reluctantly pocketed the weapon. Satisfied? Now where is he? I have no idea. I'm still hoping you can tell me. What are you talking about? You're the one who called. I was testing a theory. A theory? It's a hypothetical set of facts or principles. I can get you some literature on it. That won't be necessary. In the meantime, what interests me is why you barged in here with a gun in hand when you thought your pilferer was on the other side of the door. Isn't this a matter for the police or, frankly, the prosecutor's office? Or even just the lovely April Glover? Why bring firearms into a human resources dilemma? You sure you don't know who visited Walter at home on Monday? Benning stared at me for several seconds, unblinking eyes boring into me like the eyes in a painting that follow you around the room, down the hall, and into the pantry. Then he turned on his heels and left, slamming the door so hard that fine particles of dust drifted down from the ceiling. The grime improved the decor, I thought, sitting on the bed and sending the photo of Benning in a text message. The reply from Donna Hamrick came 2 minutes later. Yes, that's him. That's the man who came by Monday night. I had one more thing to ask her. By any chance have you found Walter's father's gun? Her reply took a full minute and confirmed my worst fear. Not yet. The next morning I sat at the kitchen table in my house in German Village, trying to keep my eyes from glazing over, as I studied online financial statements for Spurf from its most recent annual reports. Kevin Harding hadn't been kidding about the fund's assets. As of the previous June, Spurf held $79 billion in trust for nearly 500,000 Ohio teachers, both active and retired. Its assets included international equities, whatever those were, domestic equities, I envisioned black-frocked and white-aproned servants, and real estate, Walter Hamrick's division. What struck me as I compared this year's report with last year's and the one before that was that only real estate was showing healthy growth, with close to double-digit returns. That kind of growth in real estate likely translated to millions of dollars. Was it realistic Hamrick was getting away with that kind of cash? So if not embezzling, then what? What would Hamrick have been up to make Benning so eager to find him that he'd burst into the rest easy with gun in hand? I thought about the fund scandal a few years back. A bunch of board members and fund execs out on their ears. A downturn in the fund's returns thanks to the malfeasance. No Christmas bonuses, according to Kevin Harding. Yet now the fund was healthy again, in large part due to the real estate office. I thought about phoning April Glover, but decided against it after recalling the looks she and Benning exchanged in the conference room where we met. Instead, I dialed Spurf's main number and negotiated the gauntlet of options until, somewhat miraculously, Christmas season after all, I found myself speaking with Nancy. "How go the party preparations?" I said. "Other than all hell breaking loose, just fine. What can I do for you?" Suspicion lingering in her voice from our last conversation. "I just need to ask you a quick question." "Me? Listen, I told you that I shouldn't have..." "It's about Christmas bonuses," I said. "Are they back?" "What?" "I know they went south a few years ago. I just wondered if there's been a rebound in that department." A pause so long I worried she'd hung up. Then, disdain in her voice that was hard to miss, she said, "They are back, but selectively." "What's that mean?" "Real estate's getting them because they're doing so well. The other funds are flat still, so not so much." "How could they be flat in this economy?" "Hard to say. It's all in how the money's managed, you know." "Are you suggesting the same kind of management as before, as during the scandal?" "I wasn't going to say that, but real estate's okay," I said. "Better than okay, in fact." "Yes, now listen. Doesn't seem fair, them getting the bonuses, but not others. Tell me something I don't know, but that's business, I guess." "How about Walter?" "How about him what? Is he due a bonus?" She laughed. "He's too far down the food chain. Bonuses go to the asset managers, acquisition officers, appraisers, that sort." I thought about this. Thought of Walter laboring in the vineyards while the masters in the house took home end-of-year riches. Unfair as hell, but reason to disappear and perhaps take his own life? It didn't fit. "I've got to go," Nancy said. "Too many fires to put out before tonight." "Fires?" "The caterers this, the bartenders that. Plus, I called to check on our Santa, and it turns out the job got canceled somehow." "Can't you find a replacement?" "Any idea how hard it is to find a card-carrying Saint Nick this time of year?" "Say, you wouldn't be interested in..." "No thanks. Fake beards give me rashes. Listen, thanks for your help. Good luck tonight. Sorry I'll miss your sweater." "Me too," she said, hanging up. I called Donna Hamrick and gave her the status update, such as it was. I left out my feeling, based on nothing more than a nagging suspicion, that Walter was still alive. Her disconsolate tone as she thanked me matched my own mood. With nothing further to pursue at the moment, I succumbed to the inevitable and decided to finish my Christmas shopping, notwithstanding the fact I hadn't really started it yet. I drove out to East End and spent a couple hours combating the crowds at the mall, carefully studying the texted recommendations for my sons that each ex-wife sent me, before finally shoving my phone in my pocket and heading to Barnes & Noble to buy the books everyone knew I'd be giving in the first place. I was cutting through the indoor portion of the sprawling faux town center complex when I pulled up my phone at its insistent buzz. "It's Harding. Got a second? Assuming I don't die of good cheer first." Maneuvering through the crowd lined up for pictures with Santa, I explained where I was. "Braver man than me. I'm the guy they invented Amazon for. How's your Spurf thing going?" I outlined the little progress I'd made, leaving out the motel and focusing on the fund numbers I'd been analyzing and what Nancy told me. "Well, I'm not sure if this is related, but thought I'd pass it on. Remember Hurricane Todd in September? I guess, another South Florida special?" "That's right. Wiped out a bunch of prime real estate in Miami. One of the casualties was an office building owned by Spurf." "Really?" I stepped clear of the throng, watching as a screaming, red-faced girl of two or so was placed on Santa's lap. "Someone on our business desk heard about it and made a couple calls." "Okay. She, this reporter, says the numbers don't match up. The appraisal she pried loose from Spurf was almost 5 times what the county assessor's office listed for it in Florida. She called Spurf back, but they suddenly lost her number. Could it have been a mistake? That's what she thought at first, but she dug around some more and found out Spurf owns a couple more buildings down there. All 3 were overappraised. I let the implications sink in. Putting the complicated accounting aside, this sounded like good old-fashioned number fixing. Appraisers artificially boosting their figures, which could explain the real estate division's stellar performance in comparison to the rest of the fund. A division that by coincidence was pulling down the only bonuses this year. Bonuses that had all but dried up after a greedy board drew unwanted public scrutiny thanks to those far-flung junkets. Kind of financial leisure domain a brilliant but unassuming auditor of quarterly reports might stumble across. I thought about Walter Hamrick's disappearance. The insinuation by April Glover and Stuart Benning that he'd quit ahead of being fired for embezzling. But what if there was another explanation? What if he'd uncovered a new scandal, the inflation of real estate appraisals to recover lost bonuses? And what if his attempts to notify the company led not to praise, but an attempt to silence him, a la Benning's appearance at his house, which might explain Hamrick's decision to lie low for a while? "Would you quit your crying and smile for the goddamn camera?" Startled, I looked up to see a woman shaking a finger in the screaming face of the little girl on Santa's lap. Watched as the girl's wailing grew louder as her mom and Santa's handler struggled to salvage the photo op. Recalled what the harried Nancy told me on the phone earlier that day. I called to check on our Santa, and it turns out the job got canceled somehow. Say, you wouldn't be interested in. "Gotta go," I told Harding, cutting the connection, pocketing the phone, and starting to run. 20 minutes and several broken speeding limits later, I parked by a hydrant in front of the old Wendy's, leapt out of my Odyssey, and sprinted toward the entrance of Spurf. It was after hours when I started to put 2 and 2 together at the mall, and I hadn't been able to reach anyone on my desperate drive over. But I was willing to bet my best fedora that had I known which Santa booking agency to call, I would have learned that the call to cancel the Spurf job had been placed anonymously, and probably by a mild-mannered man from Central Casting. I flashed my private eye license at the startled guard at the lobby desk, vaulted the security turnstile, and jumped into an elevator just before the doors were about to close. The passengers inside, decked out in their best party duds, gawked at me during our agonizingly slow ascent to the 5th floor. "Good tidings to all," I muttered as the doors opened and I rushed into the lobby. Nancy, perched over a tray of name tags, looked up, surprised. "What are you..." "Did a Santa happen to show up?" I said, catching my breath. "Amazingly, yes," she said. "I guess it wasn't canceled after all. Why are you..." "Where?" She pointed down the hall. I sprinted, hearing laughter and music and the clink of glasses. A moment later, I entered a large lobby area where the Christmas party was in full roar. I glanced around wildly. On the right, out of the corner of my eye, I saw April Glover starting to walk toward me. Just behind her, fire in his eyes, stalked Stuart Benning. I looked to my left. Next to the carving station, the jolly old elf himself was inching toward a chair that sat empty by a window. A moment later, he climbed atop the chair. As I shouldered past startled guests, knocking glasses of holiday cheer from their hands, I watched him pull his Santa gift bag off his shoulder and dip his hand inside. My days on the gridiron didn't do my knees any favors, and there's more than one person in town who's accused me of concussion-related lapses in judgment, though to be fair, they're both my ex-wives. Despite these handicaps, I still managed a decent cross-field pattern and made it to the carving station and the elevated Santa beside it just as his hand emerged from the bag holding a gun that decidedly didn't match the rest of the holiday decor. He was shouting something as he raised the weapon when I reached him, and we both fell over in a tangle of limbs and blows and words that, like the gun, didn't fit in with the spirit of Christmas. It took a good 2 hours to sort everything out, and that didn't even include the toque-wearing chef and her non-stop lament over the loss of a perfectly good roast and ham that she'd scarcely begun carving. Part of the delay was my reluctance to lift myself off Hamrick. I recognized him as soon as I tore off his beard, as we lay on the floor like a pair of fallen nutcrackers. I kept up my refusal despite Benning's best efforts in a low, chilling voice to let him take it from here. I assured him I'd be more than happy to wait for Columbus police to arrive. The good news, if you can call it that, was the M1911 that Hamrick pulled from his goodie bag may have functioned perfectly well in the Korean theater 60-odd years earlier, but wasn't in the best working order now. That's if he even knew how to use it as part of his ill-advised plan to publicize the new scandal with a display of force, though he swore afterward he only intended to scare company executives, not hurt them. The bad news, Donna Hamrick probably had a few Christmases she'd be spending alone, at least for the near future. But she might have company in that regard, given the new scandal Spurf was facing as news of the artificially inflated appraisals began to emerge, thanks in no small part to some meticulous analysis that Walter Hamrick, through his attorney, was more than willing to provide. All that was in the future. For now, I was sitting on a couch in the nearly empty Spurf party room, texting Kevin Harding as I pondered how to pay for my boys' Christmas books now that my contract with Mrs. Hamrick had gone inconveniently south. There you are, Nancy, approaching from across the room. I stood and gazed appreciatively at tonight's sweater, the high points of which I'd missed during my rush inside, a motorcycle-riding Santa, palm trees, and sombrero-wearing penguins. I don't know about you, but I could use a real drink, she said, glancing at the solo cup of eggnog beside me. My sentiments exactly. Anything left over there? She shook her head. The bar was the first to go after the cops showed up. Shame. In that case, it just so happens I've got a sleigh parked nearby. And 8 tiny reindeer? 6 cylinders, I'm afraid. But they're all firing for. What are you in the mood for? Mood? Naughty or nice? She looked at me with interest. Are you making a list? I kept my eyes on her as I reached up and plucked a sprig of mistletoe from the ceiling overhead. And checking it twice. I warned you, I don't know anything about football. Not a problem, I said. I know all about Christmas sweaters. Naughty it is, Nancy said, hooking her arm in mine as we headed for the elevators and the moon on the crest of the new fallen snow.
Home for the Holidays is copyrighted by Andrew Welsh Huggins. Music for this podcast was obtained from purpleplanet.com. Mixing and editing were done by Kevin Wheeler and Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one by visiting our website at www.ellerycueenmysterymagazine.com.